I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Tough times, as they say, make tough people. If that's the case, there are a lot of young and middle-aged Canadians getting incredibly thick skin every month as they look at their bills. This week on In This Economy, we wanted to answer the question of what we will actually take away from this period in our economic history when it's over. Everyone who lives through chaotic times ends up with something that sticks with them. Hopefully, something that makes them better, that makes them tougher. But you never know until it happens to you. One of our listeners who has grown up in incredibly tough economic times wanted to ask us what we'll take away from this. So we tried to answer him. Enjoy.
This was not an economic downturn or a recession. This was a complete collapse.
This is Gonzalo. He's based in the Gatineau, Ottawa region, but he grew up in Argentina. Now, Gonzalo was 15 in 2001 when Argentina made the largest foreign default in world history. The country froze citizens' bank deposits and saw an abysmal devaluation of their currency. The resulting financial chaos spurred social and political turmoil. Over half the population dropped below the poverty line. More than a quarter lost their jobs. Thousands took to the streets in mass protest, and that prompted Argentina's presidency to change hands 5 times in 11 days. Puts our economic crisis in perspective.
People started to really rely on others because there was no government safety nets. There was nowhere to go.
Gonzalo and his family were middle class, but that didn't shield them from the impacts of the crisis.
It was quite devastating to see how difficult it got. My father had health issues because of that. And I got exposed to a whole new reality of the country.
The family did what you'd expect. They cut all unnecessary costs and they adapted to living on a shoestring budget. But beyond that,
we started communicating and building more connections in our community, triggered by this common need and the sensation that we were all in this situation together, something that I never experienced before. I remember seeing a lot of neighbors getting together to prepare meals and make sure everybody has food, to also secure medicine. It was something that was coming from the bottom up.
So now, Gonzalo felt prepared for the recent strains on Canada's economy.
Because it really helped me to be aware and then start to strategically cut on the areas that I was really not getting a lot out of it. But I really became very, I wouldn't say conservative, but very mindful of my spending. Even if I apply for a mortgage, I feel nervous because I know that I'm spending money that I don't have. I'm terrified of credit cards. I don't trust them. And I use them essentially just because we need to build credit.
Well, Gonzalo was ready for this moment. He can feel his peers struggling to adapt to Canada's ever-rising cost of living. So he wants to know.
How can we take that with us so we can use it and benefit from this, I would say, good habits or healthy consequences of this, not just when there's a crisis, but beyond that, when we have good times, how we can learn from this experience?
The past couple of years in Canada obviously haven't been as severe as Argentina's near-total collapse. But still, the ongoing spike in interest rates, inflation, and the cost of living have taken their toll. So how do we prepare for and adapt to harder economic times? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and you are listening to In This Economy, the show where we try to help you understand the systems that create our money problems. We tackle everything from practical issues like credit card debt, grocery bills, and mortgages, to things that influence every part of how we deal with money, starting with financial literacy. In each episode of this show, we hear from a listener like Gonzalo, who has a question about how to navigate our economy, and then we find a financial expert who can take us on a deep dive into why things are the way they are and how we can make them work to our advantage, even in this economy. Now, as much as we can try to stay positive, learn lessons, and adapt our lives to the rising cost of living, it's still frustrating. It's still hard, especially if you've run out of things to cut in the budget and you're still coming up short. It may be tempting to give up on your financial goals entirely, and then you turn on the TV or pick up your phone and you hear that the economy's doing pretty good, actually. David Coletto knows this feeling well.
There's a difference between the perception and feelings that we have about the economy and the actual economy. And when economists say, hey, folks, the economy is actually doing pretty well, it just reinforces and makes people even angrier and more frustrated because they like, I do not feel that economy in my day-to-day life.
David is the founder and CEO of Abacus Data, a company that regularly polls Canadians on what's concerning them the most. And right now, as you might imagine, which is why you're listening to this show, those issues overwhelmingly fall under the umbrella of finance. David, along with his colleague, Tanya Woods, are well aware of the general feeling of doom and gloom.
If you identify as a millennial or younger, you've been told by Canada, by the world, you're not going to be as financially successful and secure as your parents. That's definitely not encouraging.
Tanya is the head of government and regulatory affairs and policy council at Questrade Financial Group. She's also the managing director of Canada's Chamber of Digital Commerce. I called her and David to get a sense of the state of our economy, how we're feeling about it, whether we really understand the causes of the money problems most of us find ourselves in, and to ask them what we can learn from what we're dealing with right now that will help us do more than just sit back and survive it. I'll begin with David because, David, first I wanted to know from you, you know, in terms of the everyday cost of just a decent middle-class lifestyle, I think it can feel like it's never been worse than it is right now. Is that true?
There are many indicators that would suggest it is, at least in, you know, if you take anyone 40 and under, it certainly has not been this difficult to afford a lot of the things that people expect to be able to afford, even those who have a full-time job. And that is, the center of it is housing. So there's no doubt that housing is more expensive today than it has likely ever been. You know, your parents, if you're like mine, 40 years old, we'll say in, you know, 1980, when you were born, David, our interest rates were 20%. And that's true. And interest rates are not that high today. But the price of housing, whether you're looking to rent, you're looking to buy, you know, carrying a mortgage today is so much more expensive. So on that front, yes, I think things are substantially worse. And I also think we've just lived through and we're living through a period where the price of pretty much everything we need has risen substantially. And that is relatively a new phenomenon. You have to go back to the 1970s and early 80s to see another period where inflation moved as fast. So for, I would say, half of the population, this has been a moment where they have not experienced before, in a kind of economy that, while on the one hand, actually is by other measures doing pretty well, unemployment is pretty low, you know, the economy is technically still growing. But when we ask Canadians in our surveys, do you feel that the economy is doing well. Most say no, and particularly younger Canadians say absolutely not.
What does the market say about the economy on the whole?
Well, the market says, you know, we're kind of, they use the term right now, sluggish. So okay. We're technically still growing. We haven't, Canada has not gone into a technical recession, which economists define as two quarters of a declining GDP. There are some who are debating whether this measure called GDP per capita, so you take Canada's gross domestic product and you divide it by the number of people, that number has been going down, which some argue is an indicator of standard of living declining in Canada. Others say, well, it's not a very good measure. So economists don't all agree with what measure best describes the economy today. But I'm not an economist. I'm a public opinion researcher. And I think perception is everything. So, and this is why when we measure things like consumer confidence, we are starting to see an improvement compared to where it was over the last 2 years, but it is still close to neutral, meaning, you know, about half of consumers are feeling a little bit more optimistic and the other half are kind of saying, well, I'm not ready to say things have improved. And we see it in people's behavior, right? We do see people scaling back on spending on groceries, spending on a lot of discretionary things is down. But on the same time, there is still a legacy of the pandemic in which a lot of Canadians saved up quite a bit of money over that basically year, 2 years, and weren't able to do a lot of the things they wanted, like travel. So if you've been traveling, you know, people said this March break, travel reached its peak, a higher level than before the pandemic.
Really?
So people are still spending money, but they're much more choosy on it. And they're having to spend a lot more and they're getting less. And that is creating, I think, the anxiety where, you know, half of Canadians say they are living paycheck to paycheck in our surveys.
Maybe if you could, just because you touched on it at the very beginning, provide a little review of the past few decades in terms of the ups and downs of the Canadian economy. I know it's never been this bad, but, you know, in between then and now, what have most Canadians sort of experienced in terms of, again, the way the economy affects them, not how the stock market's doing?
Yeah, I would say, you know, coming out of the 80s, which was a period with interest rates were very high, the housing market, it didn't crash, but it really dipped. So it was actually a really good time to buy a house if you had money. If you didn't have money, you'd have to pay quite a bit to carry a mortgage at the time. And that's when baby boomers, if you think about the generations in Canada, were, you know, in their 20s and 30s. So that's my parents, right? Experiencing that kind of difficult, constrained economy, slow growth. And that persisted through much of the 80s and then into the 90s, particularly after the mid 90s, you actually had a period of pretty substantial growth, right? And it felt like the economy, the American economy, the Canadian economy was on all cylinders. Money was flowing. People were doing quite well. There's a lot of optimism. You know, I always think of like governments were balancing budgets and they were doing it without having, you know, the federal government in Canada cut quite a bit. But then there was this period of really strong growth into 2000. And then you had 9/11 in 2001.
Right.
And that global political crisis created a momentary economic shock because people weren't traveling and we weren't sure. There was a war started in Afghanistan. But soon after that, the economy continued to do pretty well. And you had the buildup of people taking on perhaps, particularly in the United States, more leveraging themselves in the real estate market. And then you had the financial crash in 2008, 2009, the so-called Great Recession. And Canada, it affected Canadians and the Canadian economy and how we experienced it, but not to the same extent as the United States, where you saw massive numbers of foreclosures, people losing, you know, their homes, and the government had to step in to kind of save the economy. And that happened in the United States and Great Britain and many other countries around the world. And Canada was not immune to those forces. But after that period, you did see, again, people's optimism start to improve. The economy got better. I think before the pandemic, there was this optimism built in, but the housing market started to get very expensive. Canada's population started to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pandemic hit. And you basically had 2 years of what I describe as a roller coaster of emotions for people, both their fear of getting this virus and getting sick and perhaps dying and their loved ones getting sick and dying, but also the economic uncertainty about what it meant for them, people losing their jobs, entire industries shutting down. And that was a period of immense, I think, emotional trauma that was tied to the economic well-being of a large part of the economy. And coming out of that, I think what happened was half of people who working, who didn't have to, could work from home, actually did pretty well, were okay.
Right.
And half felt, I think, a deep trauma about it. And we're still living through the legacy of that pandemic on people's finances.
In terms of that legacy, that's a great segue to get to what our listener wanted us to discuss today, which is what lessons that we will take, that Canadians will take from this period of economic instability. And at the height of the lockdowns, we saw people change their behavior in a more communal way. And I'm wondering if your survey sort of reflected that and what you heard from people during those trying times about how they changed their behavior, particularly with regard to their community.
I think it was a momentary shift, frankly. I don't know if it's persisted post-pandemic, but we saw a momentary coming together of the country and communities more specifically to help each other get through a really difficult time. And I think it happened in workplaces. I think it happened in neighborhoods. And it probably was a good year of that happening and lots of great stories coming out of it.
In terms of what people told you, you mentioned a little earlier that some people, obviously probably mostly the ones who were lucky enough to be able to work from home and have a stable income during the pandemic, had managed to save money. Did you figure out anything or see any trends in terms of how the pandemic changed the way people spend and save? And I ask you this because one of the things that I've talked about a lot on The Big Story is, you know, when you have your grandparents who lived through the Depression and so will now always have like money in the mattress or canned food in the basement. And we've talked a lot about people will now always like have extra rolls of toilet paper on hand because they experienced that. I'm wondering if there's been a lasting impact in terms of how people manage their money.
You know, I don't think there was. And
they started spending again as soon as it was over, right?
Seriously, human instinct and behavior is unpredictable, but there are things that are predictable, and that is we don't always learn from experiences. I do think a few things happened, though. We had seen already before the pandemic forced us to entertain ourselves at home because of our ability to, you know, get content on demand, if you could afford it, set up a nice, you know, TV or a number of screens in your home. We saw people spending less outside the home, so they were able to do more things at home. And that was a trend that just accelerated during the pandemic. The ability to save that many households experienced was because a lot of costs declined. So many people didn't need to commute into work. If you had children, you were forced, in fact, to care for them while you were working if you could. And so childcare costs reduced for a moment. So a lot of this non-discretionary spending that we typically have to spend in our day-to-day lives for that moment of the pandemic disappeared. And so a lot of people saved a pretty large cushion of money. And then many people got CERB and other government benefits to help support them through that period. But you didn't have to spend that money because there was not a lot to spend it on. What ended up happening, though, is the moment that we could, some folks talk about revenge spending. And revenge spending is a behavior that happens when, you know, you feel like you deserve something because you've lived through a difficult period. And so you basically had, you know, most of the world who had resources basically saying, okay, I couldn't travel for 2 years, or I didn't feel comfortable traveling, or I'm going to spend on a luxury item that I might not normally buy because I have this little bit of money and I deserve it, because I lived through this traumatic period. And you saw that happening a lot. But as prices rose, and this is partly what drove inflation, is that demand, people's desire to spend and their ability to spend was so high. And at the very moment everybody wanted to spend money, the supply was still constrained because of the impacts of the pandemic. And that is what fueled inflation. And so it spiraled and made things far worse for people. And so I actually think, you know, we had this charitable sense of things. What I'm seeing in the public mindset, and I'll end here, Jordan, is despite what we did during the pandemic and what so many people kind of contributed and built a community spirit, because of a scarcity mindset that has set in, where so many Canadians say, look, the things I need in my life, I feel are so much harder to get, so much more expensive, mm-hmm. whether that be housing, food, energy. It means we have increasingly become zero sum in our mindset, that if I'm losing, if I feel like I'm losing, it means somebody else is gaining. And that's why I think for so many people, the economy feels so, so hard today, because it's like we're fighting each other to get the basic necessities that we need to live and thrive.
I want to ask you this, but I also want to ask your colleague, Tanya Woods, who is also joining us, this question, which is, given the past 30 years, or even just going back to the 90s, when probably most of our listeners were too young to really be paying much attention to the economy, were Canadians prepared for the way everyday affordability changed as we came out of the pandemic and prices started spiking?
Financial insecurity is something that affects far too many people, right? When you ask people in a survey, if you needed to find $500 or $1,000 for an emergency, could mm-hmm. you get it? More than a third of Canadians say no to that question. When we ask, wow. we do the survey every year with HOOPE, which is the healthcare pension plan of Ontario. They run the pension plan for all healthcare workers, and they look at retirement security. Not just young people who aren't saving for retirement, but there's a substantial number of people on the cusp of retiring who have almost nothing saved. So when these moments of economic shock come, when prices rise by 10%, when housing, you know, I was looking at the stats, rent in February of 2024 went up 10% compared to February 2023, right? When you're seeing a year-over-year yeah. increase of 10% on your rent, how do you adjust for that if we aren't preparing ourselves with an emergency fund? Or and some people will say, look, I can't do that. How do I pay for food and transit and housing and then have enough at the end of the... And that's why I think we're seeing the deep, for many, skepticism and anxiety around the economy today. I think what Tanya will talk a lot about, and I agree with because we see it in our surveys, is Canadians are not financially literate. So when a moment comes in which we have to pivot in the way that we adapt to a changing economic circumstance, I don't think we're prepared for it.
Well, Tanya, I'll ask you then, what is financial literacy like across the country? How do we measure it? How does it compare to other countries? Like, give us a sense of how knowledgeable and confident Canadians are with their finances.
You know, Canadians believe, right or wrong, that they are, you know, some financially literate. 30%, I think, is a study David put out recently. And yet, when we talk about innovation that's happening, there is a tremendous amount of innovation happening in this space. Less than 15% really even know what it's about. I would say maybe closer to 10 at best.
What are we talking about when we say innovation?
Thank you for asking the question. I mean, we're talking about open banking. We're talking about crypto and digital assets. We're talking about new ways to do credit checks, new ways to set up your own savings account. We're talking about online financial services providers, online qualified advisory services, online insurance providers, online mortgage providers. Mm. Why does that matter? Well, digital service providers generally can benefit from economies of scale. They can drive costs down for their consumers because they know how to leverage technology networks. And so the promise of digital financial services is that they're going to be more affordable for Canadians if structured appropriately, if the law allows them to be. Canadians have not realized this yet. And by realized, I mean, it's not in their day-to-day life. Yes, we have, you know, online accounts. We can go look at our passbooks now in a digital format. Yes, we can place some online orders thanks to Questrade and other leaders who have pushed, you know, the online trading space. But if you don't know how to read the digital ecosystem properly, you don't yet have a relationship with it. You don't have a trust with it yet. You don't know what's possible out there in the world. And so you're missing out. But we have enough FOMO, so we're not going to pile more FOMO onto that right now. We're going to talk about literacy. And I know you've got lots of questions about that.
moving into the next space in finance is one thing. And obviously, people can debate back and forth about whether the opportunity there outweighs the risk or not when you talk about things like crypto. But I'm speaking more in terms of the general knowledge that a millennial or Canadians in general would need to put their finances in a place, and I know, again, not technically a recession, but that can survive a time of real instability, which we've seen over the past couple years, and how many Canadians are equipped for that, and what would you suggest that Canadians who aren't equipped for that learn as quickly as possible to be able to navigate what looks like an increasingly unstable economy?
So we do feel that there's big F financial literacy, which is all encompassing. That includes understanding how insurance works. That includes, yes, of course, understanding your budgets. Canadians are being called because of the situation we're in to engage with higher level thinking around economics and inflation. For many Canadians, I'm not sure they could explain to you what inflation is and how it works. They just know it's a bad word right now. And we need Canadians to understand it a little better, because then they can engage on the topic more, you know, more directly with their politicians and maybe influence some policies to help them. That this is big F financial literacy, understanding, of course, in that bucket, fintechs and the innovation side is one aspect of it. Understanding the mortgage ecosystem, you know, how do mortgages even work? Mm-hmm. Many Canadians maybe make that step once in their life. And usually it's about the time when they're ready to buy a house, but they don't often go back to say, well, what did I learn from that process? Not many are mortgage experts. It's a very fortunate position to be in, especially these days, to be seeking a mortgage to buy your house. But when you're holding a mortgage today and you're having trouble making payments, you're wondering. I think a lot of Canadians are wondering, what was that decision actually about?
Yeah.
And, you know, hard to backtrack it, isn't it? So I think getting the basics down, the budgeting, and they know these are the products and services I have, and here's how they work for me. Here's how they relate to my financial goals. That's small F financial literacy. And then big F is understanding the whole ecosystem in front of us today, because it has rapidly evolved. Canadians have knowledge gaps. I have knowledge gaps. I would be lying to tell you that I knew everything about everything. I absolutely do not. And it's changing all the time. So, you know, the other side of this that I think is important to highlight is there is no shame in not knowing.
What do you do when you don't know?
You learn. We have FCAC. So this is a government organization that is set up and it has a legal mandate. So it's required to be out there helping Canadians learn. The full wording of FCAC, for those that aren't familiar with it, is Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. But it is responsible for the National Financial Literacy Strategy. So I encourage Canadians first to go there. The second thing that you can do is think through, who are your financial services providers today? Certainly Questrade and many others have resources right on their websites where you can start to kind of poke around and see, what are they telling me? What can I do with this product? You know, is it the right thing for me? Some have budgeting tools to help you figure out, you know, what is my budget? How should I be looking at this? And there's a lot of resources out there. I think, you know, the challenge is you can get lost down many rabbit holes and in the ocean of information. And so it is really ideal that we try to guide our government, I think, at this time to be enhancing what FCAC is doing for Canadians. I think having a national hub that is best in class in the world would be a very helpful start federally. But we also look at countries like Denmark. And in Denmark, I mean, we're seeing financial literacy directly tied to strong economies. Hmm. There, people are learning at 12 through 15 exactly what this means at many levels, not just the basic, you know, home ec budgeting level.
Well, that's an excellent way to cover what we can do to educate ourselves ahead of any major financial decisions or before we plan a budget or anything like that. But what can we take away from the past couple years or even this year as it continues that will help recession-proof our personal finances? I know we have no control over the general economy. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I mean, look, number one, understand the world's changing rapidly. It's changing for so many reasons that are not in our individual control. So having goals from what you want to achieve and the life you want to live, you have to think a little longer term, you know, think short term, but also long term, having both perspectives kind of going all the time and revisiting your objectives and your vision for how you want your life to go and how you're going to use money, what you need it to be doing for you. It's really important to first put some thought into your own objectives. Then it's important, of course, to equip yourself with the knowledge on how to do that. You can reverse order those if you like, but sometimes learning in a more directed context is a little bit easier, guides you. And then get familiar with the products and services out there. The government is aware that there is an issue, and they have been introducing a lot of new programs and opportunities for Canadians. One being, of course, the first home savings account for those Canadians that are, you know, interested and want to have a home and buy a home one day. This is something, you know, Questrade is really proud to support and to develop that product and get it into market first. And from that, just that initial initiative of government and then our company's leadership, what we experienced were customers starting to ask more questions. It's easy to get overwhelmed, but pick your first thing and just start. And then the other aspect of it is read. Read widely, understand sort of how does government impact what you do, and engage with your politicians. I think, you know, Canadians have had for many years a bit of a complacent tendency when it comes to public engagement with their political representatives. This is a moment in time. We can't sit back. Once we figure out what we need and we have a better understanding of what's going on in the ecosystem, we can do part of our research engaging with our local politicians and saying, listen, how can you help me? That's their job. Their job is to serve the public. How can you help me? Can you get me better education through these bodies like FCAC? Can you help me solve my challenge over here with my housing concerns? Can you help me define financial future for me here in this country? We have a very busy election cycle coming up, and I think these are going to be, in fact, I'm fairly confident David would probably backstop it with his data, but I'm fairly confident these are going to stay election issues, and I think they're going to make or break the election. So the more Canadians engaged, asking, demanding, seeking engagement and asking what their politicians are going to do for them on these topics is really, really important, because it does set the tone and direction for our country and the policies that guide it economically and financially.
Because you mentioned it, I will ask you, David, and I'm fairly certain already of the answer, but economy and affordability, where Canadians rank it on the issues that they'll be voting on?
Number one, close to 90% of Canadians put either the cost of living or housing affordability as a top three issue. And so as long as that is the mindset that people have, I think it will affect everything. It will affect the decisions they're making as consumers, and it will have a political impact as well. And we're seeing its effect here in Canada and around the world. There's no incumbent government that isn't being harmed by what I call inflation-itis, which is the impact that inflation and this feeling of falling behind has on voters. But I'll say this, because I think this has been kind of a downer a little bit podcast. And that's the nature
welcome
of the world.
Welcome to In This Economy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but that's it. But look, I also am somebody who's generally a glass half full kind of person. And I look around and I say, living today, it's never been easier for you to be in control of your finances, to connect all of the dots, to know and power your financial future if you choose to, if you choose to take control.
Right. You don't have to have a mysterious stockbroker handling your money anymore.
Exactly. Right. And it's never been easier to connect globally to markets. So I think we sometimes fall into the trap also of it's never been as bad. And that is true on some issues, but it's never been as easy to achieve things as well.
Tanya, before we wrap up, you mentioned complacency and not being complacent as a lesson that we can learn. And I'll ask you, you know, as we go through this period where interest rates have shot up and inflation has shot up and now is coming down, do you think Canadians are kind of waiting for the economy to just calm down, kind of go back to normal, you know, go back to sleep being okay and affordable again, and then so that they can stop caring about it? And will that ever happen now?
I think there's definitely an aspect of that. We've been very privileged as a country for a very long time when it comes to economic stability. I mean, David referenced the financial crisis in 2008, and the government at the time was really proud that it had just skated past it. I lived in the U.S. in 2008, and I ended up coming home because there were no jobs. And I'm a highly educated individual. I graduated top of my class that year, and they were paying people to not come to work. So, you know, I don't take for granted anything. You know, we are so hyper connected to any number of services and opportunities, but that can be overwhelming. So we can't take that overwhelm for granted. I mean, whether we're comfortable with it or not, we do have to take responsibility, each one of us, for our situation.
Thank you both so much for this. And I guess the lessons are don't be afraid to learn, don't be intimidated to learn, and then don't assume the economy will stay one way forever. Thanks again to Tanya and David for taking the time to teach us a bit more about the economy, but also about how to learn about the economy, and for giving us a much-needed check into how well we actually understand our own finances, let alone all the market forces affecting them. And of course, thank you to Gonzalo for reaching out with your experience living through an economic crash and sharing the lessons you learned as a result. I hope we take some of those to heart. If you would like to reach out with a money question and get some advice from an expert, then we want to hear from you. You can email us anytime at hello@itepod.com. You can also call us and leave a voicemail and talk out your problem. That number is 416-935-5935. One more time, 416-935-5935. I don't need to know your real name, but we do need a way to get in touch with you if we're going to get to your question. So we need your real number, your phone number, and also the numbers of the problems you're dealing with. If you want more in this economy, I have good news for you. We're going to keep doing this show every week for the foreseeable future, or until you stop listening. But we're also going to change things up a bit in the coming weeks. We will still answer your financial questions with experts and perspectives that will hopefully help you achieve your goals. But we will also be bringing you stories and information about Canada's economy as it happens, so you will get a little more perspective on what's going on right now in various areas of the economy and how it will impact you. So look for that in the coming weeks, right here in this feed. You don't have to do anything, except, of course, for rating and reviewing and following and subscribing and doing all of those other things that help other people find this show, too. I'm your host and executive producer, Jordan Heath Rawlings. This episode was written and produced by Ali Graham. The sound design was done by Ryan Clark, and Stephanie Phillips is our showrunner. Mary Jubrin is our digital editor, and Diana Kay is our manager of business development. Together, that makes us the Frequency Podcast Network, and yes, we're a division of Rogers. Thanks once again for listening, and we'll talk to you next week on In This Economy.